This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just how long do we carry the wounds that we suffer early in our lives? Can you find a pathway to healing and wholeness after you're broken or damaged, whether it's by tragedy or neglectful parenting? Can you recover and rebuild after you miss chances or make poor choices? These are just some of the questions Kelly Forden explores in her new collection of short stories, Garden for the Blind. It's part of the Made in Michigan Writers series. Kelly writes poetry and fiction, and she's a writer in residence for Inside Out Literary Arts in Detroit. A pleasure to have you with us, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
So these short stories start in 1974 and take us 40 years all the way up to 2014, and a lot of the focus is on Alice Townley, and she's only four when we first meet her. Tell us about Alice and her family and her circumstances when we meet her.
Well, Alice is part of a privileged family on the outskirts of Detroit. She's in a suburb. They're very, very privileged. Her father runs a automobile parts company, and they have everything going for them, and then a tragedy mm-hmm. happens.
And she is broken at a very early age by the family tragedy and also this wealthy, disinterested, self-centered mother and father. In fact, I have to say, mm-hmm. I nominate Alice's mom for one of the worst moms in fiction award ever.
I know.
Where did you draw that from?
Well, I have to say, I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I grew up in a political atmosphere, mm-hmm. and I actually attended a party quite like that Great Gatsby party, and I'd always wanted to use it in a story. So I sort of, you know, took that and brought it to Detroit. It was easy because Jerry Ford is from Detroit.
And we should let everybody know, we're going to have you read an excerpt from this, but yes, just Jerry Ford, Vice President Ford, mm-hmm. is the guest of honor at this party. So these are clearly prestigious people who have a lot of wealth.
Exactly. And they're not paying any attention to their children. And there are a bunch of protesters at the party, and yeah. they're very angry about things going on in the economy. So no one actually is paying attention to Alice or her sister. Mm-hmm. So then it was very easy to imagine that parents who would be so caught up in their lives that they would just miss things.
And then Alice goes through school and meets more wealthy, spoiled, mm-hmm. damaged kids, particularly a boy named Mike Gallagher, mm-hmm. whose mother is a popular Detroit TV news anchor. And here we go with another absent parent.
Right.
And the price that kids pay for that.
Well, you know, I really wanted to examine privilege can be great, but it can also be very dangerous. And so these kids end up doing a lot of damage because they are damaged. And that was one of the things I wanted to look at, really, the price that comes with privilege and, you know, all of the leniency that goes along with that as well.
In fact, you know, you look at the kids in your stories, and they do echo kids that we've all seen in news stories or heard about, that they're spoiled, nasty, drug-using, entitled brats. But you peel that away and help us understand what made them spoiled, nasty, drug-abusing brats.
Right. Well, I was in a workshop with Paul Harding, who wrote Tinkers, and a bunch of the people in the workshop, we workshopped the third story, which is where Alice and Mike do something terrible. Mm-hmm. And everybody who read that story said, these kids are awful. I don't want to read anything about them. I don't want to know any more about them. And I feel nothing for them. And I realized at that point, I had to go back and write their backstory. I mean, they couldn't just be monsters.
So. Right, because they are.
Right.
In that story you're talking about, this,
yeah.
we have a series of these stories. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to deny that, but the fact you did give us a sense of that. I would yeah. love if you would, if you could give us a sense for the beautiful way that you give your readers a sense of place. And if you would read from the first story in Garden for the Blind, and it's called The Great Gatsby Party. So as we were saying, this is where four-year-old Alice and her seven-year-old sister Queenie are up in their playroom mm-hmm. In their big mansion by the lake. It's a big, big party their parents are given, as we said, with the Fords as their special guests. And Queenie has commanded her little sister Alice to go downstairs and get us some food.
Right. Alice inched along the wall from the living room to the grand staircase and crawled up a few steps so that she could see the front door over the heads of the partygoers. Her mother opened the door a smidge and peeked out. "What's the password?" she said, looking back to wink at the people behind her. Everyone had been instructed to give a password on entering the party. Alice knew this because originally Queenie was the one who was supposed to stand at the door and ask each arrival for the password. Of course, their mother had asked Queenie because Queenie was her pet, the one that her mother called Miss America. Whenever her mother hosted her tennis team or her bridge club, she walked Queenie around like a show pony. But Alice had also heard her mother say that Queenie was going to be trouble. And Alice thought this was right. Queenie was giving her trouble every single day. On the morning of the Great Gatsby party, Queenie had said no, she wouldn't wear the Nixon mask. "It smells," she'd yelled, before flinging it on the ground and running off. "Imogene Townley, get back here," their mother had yelled. "I'm not asking you, I'm telling you." As Queenie fled up the stairs, their mother turned to Alice, and for a moment Alice thought she might be chosen as Queenie's replacement. "Go upstairs and play," her mother said with a dismissive wave. "I can't get anything done with you underfoot." Now her mother picked up the mask and was putting it on herself. "What's the password, dear?" Alice heard the man on the other side of the front door ask. "Gordon, dear," a woman's voice answered. "Gordon," the man repeated. "Then I'll liddy you right in," her mother said, opening the door and flinging her arms out in welcome. The Nixon mask looked like silly putty, and her mother had to hold it in place because it kept slipping down. Everyone clapped and laughed. The man in the doorway was tall. His face reminded Alice of vanilla pudding swirled with a spoon. The woman was holding a long cigarette holder out to one side. The glowing tip grazed the wall near the gilt mirror. But just as Alice was starting to worry about a fire, the woman stepped into the room. "You are too much, Michelle." The woman leaned into Alice's mother and waited for her to remove the mask so she could give her a peck on the cheek. "I couldn't resist," her mother said. "Don't you look beautiful, Betty?" Then she turned back to the crowd behind them to announce their arrival. "Vice President and Betty Ford." Everyone whooped and clapped, and Alice watched the man and his wife parade into the room. She couldn't understand why her mother, whose voice had sounded wobbly, had called the woman beautiful. She was old and skinny, and she walked sideways like Queenie's hermit crab. Alice headed back up to the fort holding her goodies in the paper bag. Queenie had opened the window and was leaning out. Animal-like sounds rose up from the street. Alice joined her to look at the people booing and shaking their fists at her house. When Queenie saw the bag, she grabbed it to rummage through. "Cream puffs," she squealed, popping one into her mouth.
The view from a four-year-old child. That's Kelly Forden reading from her collection of interlaced short stories, Garden for the Blind. When you said you had experience growing up in Washington with a big party, who was the special guest?
Jerry Ford.
Were you little then? Were how
I
old?
Was little. I was. Yeah. I was. There was some truth to that story in terms of there were no protesters, mm-hmm. But I was at a Great Gatsby party with him, and it was right before Ford became president.
Right on the verge of that Nixon resignation. Your stories in Garden for the Blind take us from these affluent Detroit suburbs to the poorest neighborhoods of Detroit where we discover a Garden for the Blind. We go to Alaska. We go near Lake Erie in northern Ohio. And we see violence, we see tragedy, we see meanness, neglect, and we also see some healing and hope. And I'm wondering how you think that the healing and hope can grow from that neglect and bad choices and tragedy.
Well, I think it was interesting to follow two kids because, you know, privilege, I think, means that you don't have to look something in the eye. She's never no one ever tells her she must confront what she's done wrong. So she never does, really. I mean, and the other boy, Mike, is a little bit more conscientious, and he has a conscience. Mm-hmm. I think if you have a conscience, you can change things. I do think at the end, in the last story especially, I was aware of the fact that everybody involved in that story viewed what was happening from their own perspective. So then that led me as a writer, it was kind of fun to realize that everybody has their own perspective on life and you can't see everything happening around you. And in a way, you are blind to the plight of other people. So in a way, I think Mike is able to see more than Alice is. I don't think that Alice can see anything besides her own you know, immediate circle.
Doesn't she kind of echo her mom?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she does. Mm-hmm. And the man she chose to marry,
right,
kind of like her dad.
Right.
The sins of the parents.
Exactly, yeah. She just has no self-awareness at all. And it was sad for me because I kept hoping she would change, and she never did. It just felt true to me. You know, I don't want to give away
yes,
too much,
no.
But it feels true to me that she followed the path she followed.
How do you think Michigan, and you grew up in D.C., what brought you to Michigan?
My husband is actually from Grosse Pointe.
Okay.
So we returned there after we finished our graduate programs in Ohio. We came back to Michigan.
And how do you feel that Michigan in the Midwest has left a mark on your writing?
To be really honest, when I first moved to Grosse Pointe, I was aware of this great racial divide, especially along Jefferson Avenue, and it really bothered me. I was from D.C. I had grown up with a lot of diversity. Everything seemed so integrated. And at that time, back in the early 90s, it was a completely different story here. I couldn't believe it, honestly. It's not been solved at all. The reason that I didn't name that Grosse Pointe in the book is because I do feel like that could happen in any suburb. And I, you know, everybody else gets off the hook. If I name it Grosse Pointe, no other suburb has to answer to that. And it's really more widespread. But, I mean, things are beginning to change. You know, another reason I didn't name it Grosse Pointe is because I have a lot of wonderful friends there who are not at all like the Townleys. And I didn't want to implicate them. But it's a problem. It's definitely a problem still, obviously, as we know.
It is a very beautiful linked story collection by Kelly Forden. It's Garden for the Blind, and it's part of the Made in Michigan Writers series. A very, very good read. I highly recommend it, Garden for the Blind. Kelly, it was great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.